blue object in the center of a sphere of anomalies that the computers interpreted as being approximately the same size as the ring. Gates to God knew where.
"I don't know what the hell we're doing here," he said under his breath.
"Eh, shut them men, brother," Serge said, pale-faced from his desk.
A connect request popped on Bull's hand terminal, the alert red of senior staff. With dread growing at the back of his throat, Bull accepted it. Sam appeared on the screen.
"Hey," she said, "this whole act like we're in a battle thing where we aren't supposed to get out of our crash couches? I'd really appreciate it if you could ease up enough to let us make sure the ship isn't falling apart."
"You getting alerts?"
"No," Sam admitted. "But we just sailed the behemoth into a region of space with different, you know, laws of physics and stuff. Makes me want to take a peek."
"We got 8 ships coming in right behind us," Bull said. "Hold tight until we see how that shakes down."
Sam smiled in a way that expressed her annoyance with him perfectly.
"You can get the teensiest bit paternalistic sometimes, Bull. You know that?"
A new alert popped up by Sam's face. A high priority message was coming into the comm array. From the Rocinante.
"Sam, I got something here. I'll get back to you."
"I'll be sitting in my couch doing nothing," she said.
He flipped over to the incoming message. It was a broadcast. A belter woman, with black hair pulled back from her face in a style that gave Bull the impression she'd been welding something before she'd begun the broadcast, and would be again as soon as she was finished, looked into the camera.
"Nagata, executive officer of the Rocinante. I want to make it very clear that the previous broadcast claiming our ownership of the ring was a fake. Our communications array was hijacked, and we were locked out of it. The saboteur on board has confessed, and I am including a data file at the end of this transmission with all the evidence we have about the real perpetrator of these crimes. I am also including a short documentary presentation on what we've discovered in the time we've been here that Monica Stewart and her team produced. I want to reiterate here, Captain Holden had no mandate from anyone to claim the ring. He had no intention of doing so, and none of us had any participation in or knowledge of the bomb on the Sung-un or on any other ship. We were here solely as transport and support for a documentary team and pose no intentional threat whatsoever to any other vessel."
Serge grunted, unconvinced.
"You think they fragged him? Keep Jim Holden from grabbing the camera? Fragged him or tied him up," Bill said.
It was a joke, but there was something in it.
Why wasn't the Rocinante's captain the one making the announcement?
"We will not surrender our ship," the belter said. "We will invite inspectors aboard to verify what we've reported with the following conditions. First, the inspectors will have to comply with basic safety." 5 more communication alerts popped up, all from different ships, all broadcast. If they were flying into the teeth of a vast and malefic alien intelligence, by God, they were going to go down squabbling.
"Unacceptable. We demand the immediate surrender of the Tachi and all accompanying. What confirmation can you provide that James Holden at once for interrogation? If your claims are verified, we will..."
"Message repeats.
Please confirm and clarify EVA activity, Rocinante. Who have you got out there, and where are they going?"
Bull pulled up the sensor array and began a careful sweep of the area around Holden's ship. It took him half a minute to find it. A single EVA suit, burning away from the ship and heading for the blue glowing structure in the center of the sphere. He said something obscene. 5 minutes later, the exo of the Rocinante spoke again to confirm Bull's worst suspicions.
"This is Naomi Nagata," she said, "executive officer and acting captain of the Rocinante. Captain Holden is not presently available to take questions, meet with any representatives, or surrender himself into anybody's custody. He is," she looked down,
Bull couldn't tell if it was fear or embarrassment or a little of both. The Belter took a deep breath and continued. He is conducting an EVA approach of the base at the middle of the slow zone. We have reason to believe he was called there. Bull's laughter pulled Surge's attention. Surge lifted his hand, the physical Belter idiom for asking a question. Bull shook his head.
Just trying to think of a way we could be doing this worse, he said.
Ashford insisted that they meet in person. So even though Bull had ordered that all crew members not performing essential functions remain in their couches, he himself floated to the lift and headed to the bridge. The crew was a muted cacophony. Every station was juggling telemetry and signal switching and sensor data, even though basically nothing was going on. It was just that the excitement demanded that everything be busy and serious and fraught. The excitement, or else the fear. The monitors were set to a tactical display. Earth in blue, Mars in red, the behemoth in orange, and the artifact at the center of the sphere in a deep forest green. The debris ring was marked in white, and two dots of gold, one for the Rosinante, well ahead of the other ships, and another for her captain. The scale was so small, Bull could see the shapes of the larger ships, boxy and awkward in the way that structures built for vacuum could be. The universe shrunk down to a knot smaller than the sun, and still unthinkably vast. And in that bubble of darkness, mystery, and dread, two matched dots, one blue, the other red, moving steadily toward the little gold Holden. Marine skiffs, hardly more than a wide couch strapped on the end of a fusion drive. Bull had ridden on boats like them so long ago it seemed like a different lifetime, but if he closed his eyes, he could still feel the rattle of the thrusters transferred through the shell of his armor. Some things he would never forget. How long, Ashford said, until you can put together a matching force? Bull rubbed his palm against his chin, shrugged.
How long did it take to get back to Tycho?
Ashford's face went red.
I'm not interested in your sense of humor, Mr. Baca. Earth and Mars have both launched interception teams against the outlaw James Holden. If we don't have a force of our own out there, we look weak. We're here to make sure the OPA remains the equal of the inner planets, and we're going to do that, whatever it takes. Am I clear?
You're clear, sir.
So how long would it take?
Bull looked at Pa. Her face was carefully blank. She knew the answer as well as he did, but she wasn't going to say it. Leaving the shit job for the Earther. Well, all right.
It can't be done, Bull said. Each one of those skiffs is carrying half a dozen Marines in full battle dress, powered armor. Maybe Goliath class for the Martians, Reaver class for the Earthers. Either way, I don't have anything in that league. And the soldiers inside those suits have trained for exactly this kind of combat every day for years. I've got a bunch of plumbers with rifles I could put on a shuttle.
The bridge went quiet. Ashford crossed his arms.
Plumbers? With rifles? Is that how you see us, Mr. Baca?
I don't question the bravery or commitment of anyone on this crew, Bull said. I believe that any team we sent over there would be willing to lay down their lives for the cause. Of course, that would only take about 15 seconds, and I won't send our people into that.
The implication floated in the air as gently as they did. You're the captain. You can make the order, but you'll own the consequences. And they'll know the Earther told you what would happen. Pa's eyes were narrow and looked away.
Thank you, Mr. Baca, Ashford said. You're dismissed.
Bull saluted, turned, and launched himself for the lift. Behind him, the bridge crew started talking again, but not as loud. Probably they'd all get reamed once Bull was gone,
just because they'd been in the room when Ashford got embarrassed. The chances were slim that they'd be sending anyone to the thing, nucleus, base, whatever it was. Bull couldn't think of a way to do any better than that, so that would count for a win. On the way back to his station, he looked over the data file the Rosinante had sent out. The saboteur seemed legitimate enough. Bull had seen enough faked confessions to recognize the signs, and this didn't have them. After that, though, the whole damn thing turned into a fairy tale. A mysterious woman who manipulated governments and civilians, who was willing to kill dozens of people and risk thousands in order to... do what? Put James Holden through the ring, where he was going now? The image the prisoner had built looked like it had been carved from ice. No one had added color. Bull put on an even olive flesh tone and brown hair, and the face didn't look familiar. Juliet Mao, they said. She hadn't been the first person infected with the protomolecule, but everyone before her had gotten thrown in an autoclave one way or the other. She'd been the seed crystal that Eros had used to make itself, to make the ring. So who was to say she couldn't be wandering around hiring traitors and placing bombs? The problem with living with miracles was that they made everything seem plausible. An alien weapon had been lurking in orbit around Saturn for billions of years. It had eaten thousands of people, hijacking the mechanisms of their bodies for its own ends. It had built a wormhole gate into a kind of haunted sphere. So, why not the rest? If all that was possible, everything was. Bull didn't buy it. Back at the security desk, he checked the status. The skiff of Earth Marines had gone too fast, trying to race ahead of the Martian force. The slow zone had caught them, and the skiff was drifting off toward the ring of debris. Chances were that all the men in it were dead. The Martian skiff was still on track, but Holden would reach the structure before they got to him. It was too bad, in a way. The Martians had been the trigger-happy ones all along. Chances of someone getting to question Holden were looking pretty long. Bull sucked his teeth, half-formed ideas shifting in the back of his mind. Holden wasn't getting interrogated, but that didn't mean no one would. He checked his security codes. Ashford hadn't blocked him from using the comm laser. Protocol would have been to discuss this with Ashford, or at least Pa, but they had their hands full right now anyway. And if it worked, it would be hard for them to object. They'd have a bargaining chip. The Rosinante's XO appeared on the screen. "What can I do for you, Behemoth?"
"Carlos Baca here. I'm security chief. Wanted to talk about maybe taking a problem off your hands."
She hoisted her eyebrows, her head shaking like she was trying to stay awake. She had a smart face. "I've got a lot of problems right now," she said. "Which one were you thinking about?"
"You got a bunch of civvies on your ship, one of them under arrest. Mars is still saying you're flying their ship. Earth is wondering whether you blew the shit out of one of theirs. I can take custody of your prisoner and give the rest of them a safer place than you can.
Last I checked, the OPA was the only one that's actually shot at us so far," she said. She had a good smile. Too young for him, but 10 years ago, he'd have been asking her if he could make her dinner around now. "Doesn't put you at the top of my list."
"That was me," Bull said. "I won't do it this time."
It got him a chuckle, but it was the bleak kind. The one that came from someone wading through hell.
"Look, you've got a lot going on, and you've got a bunch of people on there who aren't your crew. You've got to keep them safe, and it's a distraction. You send them over here, and everyone will see you aren't trying to control access to them. Makes this whole thing about how it wasn't you that blew the shit out of the Sung Un that much easier for people to believe."
"I think we're past goodwill gestures," she said.
I think goodwill gestures are the only chance you have to avoid a field promotion, Bo said. They're sending killers after your captain. Good ones. No one's thinking straight here. You and me, we can start cooling things down, acting like grown-ups. And if we do, maybe they do too. No one else needs to get killed.
Thin hope, she said.
It's all the hope I got. You got nothing to hide. Then show them that. Show everyone.
It took her 20 seconds. All right, she said. You can have them. Chapter 22. Holden.
Wow, Holden said to himself. I really don't want to do this.
The sound echoed in his helmet, competing only with the faint hiss of his radio.
I tried to talk you out of it, Naomi replied, her voice somehow managing to be intimate, even flattened and distorted by his suit's small speakers.
Sorry, I didn't think you were listening.
Ah, she said, irony.
Holden tore his eyes away from the slowly growing sphere that was his destination and spun around to look for the Rosinante behind him. She wasn't visible until Alex fired a maneuvering thruster, and a gossamer cone of steam reflected some of the sphere's blue glow. His suit told him that the Rosi was over 30,000 kilometers away, more than twice as far as any two people on Earth could ever be from each other, and receding. And here he was, in a suit of vacuum armor, wearing a disposable EVA pack that had about 5 minutes of thrust in it. He'd burned 1 minute, accelerating toward the sphere. He'd burn another, slowing down when he got there. That left enough to fly back to the Rosi when he was done. Optimism, expressed as conservation of Delta V. Ships from the three fleets had begun coming through the gate even before he'd started his trip. The Rosi was now protected from them only by the absolute speed limit of the slow zone. She was drifting off at just under that limit to put as much space between her and the fleets as possible. They had a sphere 1 million kilometers in diameter to play with, even without going beyond the area marked by the gates. The gates had close to 50,000 kilometers of empty space between them, but the idea of flying out of the slow zone and into that starless void beyond made Holden's skin crawl. He and Naomi had agreed it would be a maneuver of last resort. As long as no one could fire a ballistic weapon, the Rosi should be plenty safe with 500 quadrillion square kilometers to move around in. Holden spun back around, using 2 quarter-second blasts from his EVA pack, and took a range reading to the sphere. He was still hours away. The minute-long burst he'd fired from the pack to start his journey had accelerated him to a slow crawl, astronomically speaking, and the Rosi had come to a relative stop before releasing him. He'd never have had enough juice in the EVA pack to stop himself if the ship had flung him out at the slow zone's maximum speed. Ahead, in the middle of all that starless black, the blue sphere waited. It had waited for 2 billion years for someone to come through his particular gate, if the researchers were right about how long ago Phoebe had been captured by Saturn. But lately, the strangeness surrounding the protomolecule and the ring left Holden with a disquieting feeling that maybe all of the assumptions they'd made about its origins and purpose were wrong. Protogen had named the protomolecule and decided it was a tool that could redefine what it meant to be human. Jules-Pierre Mao had treated it like a weapon. It killed humans, therefore it was a weapon. But radiation killed humans, and a medical X-ray machine wasn't intended as a weapon. Holden was starting to feel like they were all monkeys playing with a microwave. Push a button, a light comes on inside. So it's a light. Push a different button and stick your hand inside. It burns you. So it's a weapon. Learn to open and close the door.
It's a place to hide things. Never grasping what it actually did, and maybe not even having the framework necessary to figure it out. No monkey ever reheated a frozen burrito. So, here the monkeys were, poking the shiny box and making guesses about what it did. Holden could tell himself that in his case, the box was asking to be poked, but even that was making a lot of assumptions. Miller looked human, had been human once, so it was easy to think of him as having human motivations. Miller wanted to communicate. He wanted Holden to know or do something. But it was just as likely, more likely maybe, that Holden was anthropomorphizing something far stranger. He imagined himself landing on the station, and Miller saying, "James Holden, you and only you in the universe have the correct chemical composition to make a perfect wormhole fuel." Then, stuffing him into a machine to be processed. "Everything okay?" Naomi asked in response to his chuckle. "Still just thinking how incredibly stupid this is. Why didn't I let you talk me out of it?" "It looks like you did, but it took a couple of hours for it to process. Want us to come get you?" "No. If I bail out now, I'll never have the balls to try it again," Holden said. "How's it look out there?" The fleets came through with about 24 ships, mostly heavies. Alex has figured out the math on doing short torpedo burns to get one up to the speed limit but not over, which means everyone on those other ships are doing the same thing. So far, no one has fired at us. "Maybe your protestations of my innocence worked?" "Maybe," she said. "There were a couple of small ships detaching from the fleet on an intercept course with you. The Rossi is calling them landing skiffs." "Shit. They're sending the Marines after me?" "They've burned up to the speed limit, but the Rossi says you make stationfall before they catch you. But just before." "Damn," Holden said. "I really hope there's a door." "They lost the UN ship. The other is Martian. So maybe they brought Bobby. She can make sure the others are nice to you." "No," Holden said with a sigh. "No, these will be the ones that are still mad at me." Knowing the Marines were following made the back of his neck itch. Being in a spacesuit just added that to his already lengthy list of insoluble problems. On the good news level, Monica's team is getting evacuated to the behemoth. "You never did like her?" "Not much, no." "Why not?" "Her job is digging up old things," Naomi said, the lightness of her tone almost covering her anxieties. "And digging up old things leads to messes like this one." When Holden was 9, Rufus, the family Labrador, died. He'd already been an adult dog when Holden was born, so Holden had only ever known Rufus as a big, black, slobbering bundle of love. He'd taken some of his first steps, clutching the dog's fur in one stubby fist. He'd run around their Montana farm, not much bigger than a toddler, with Rufus as his only babysitter. Holden had loved the dog with the simple intensity only children and dogs share. But when he was 9, Rufus was 15, and old for such a big dog. He slowed down. He stopped running with Holden, barely managing a trot to catch up, then gradually only a slow walk. He stopped eating. And one night he flopped onto his side next to a heater vent and started panting. Mother Elise had told him that Rufus probably wouldn't last the night, and even if he did, they'd have to call the vet in the morning. Holden had tearfully sworn to stay by the dog's side. For the first couple of hours, he held Rufus's head on his lap and cried as Rufus struggled to breathe and occasionally gave one half-hearted thump of his tail. By the third, against his will and every good thought he'd had about himself, Holden was bored. It was a lesson he'd never forgotten, that humans only have so much emotional energy. No matter how intense the situation or how powerful the feelings, it was impossible to maintain a heightened emotional state forever. Eventually, you'd just get tired and want it to end. For the first hours drifting toward the glowing blue station, Holden had felt awe at the immensity of empty, starless space around him. He'd felt fear of what the protomolecule might want from him, fear of the Marines following him, fear that he'd made the wrong choice, and that he'd arrive at the station to find nothing at all. Most of all, fear that he'd never see Naomi or his crew again. But after 4 hours of being alone in his spacesuit, even the fear burned out. He just wanted it all to be over with. With the infinite and unbroken black all around him, and the only visible spot of light coming from the blue sphere directly ahead, it was easy to feel like he was in some vast tunnel, slowly moving toward the exit. The human mind didn't do well with infinite spaces. It wanted walls, horizons, limits. It would create them if it had to. His suit beeped at him to let him know it was time to replenish his O2 supply. He pulled a spare bottle out of the webbing clipped to his EVA pack and attached it to the suit's nipple. The gauge on his HUD climbed back up to 4 hours and stopped. The next time he had to refill, he'd be on the station or in Marine custody. One way or the other, he wouldn't be alone anymore, and that was a relief. He wondered what his mothers would have thought about all this, whether they would have approved of the choices he'd made, how he could arrange to have a dog for their children, since Naomi wouldn't be able to live at the bottom of the gravity well. His attention wandered, and then his mind. He awoke to a harsh buzzing sound, and for a few seconds slapped his hand at empty space trying to turn his alarm off. When he finally opened sleep-gummed eyes, he saw his HUD flashing a proximity warning. He'd somehow managed to fall asleep until the station was only a few kilometers away. At that distance, it loomed like a gently curving wall of metallic blue, glowing with its own inner light. No radiation alarms were flashing, so whatever made it glow wasn't anything his suit thought was dangerous to him. The flight program Alex had written for him was spooling out on the HUD, counting down to the moment when he'd need to do his minute-long deceleration burn. Waving his hand around when he first woke up had put him into a gentle rotation, and the flight program was prompting him to allow it to make course corrections. Since he trusted Alex completely on matters of navigation, Holden authorized the suit to handle the descent automatically. A few quick bursts of compressed gas later, he was facing out into the black, the sphere at his back. Then came a minute-long burn from the pack to slow him to a gentle half-meter per second for landing. He kicked on his boot magnets, not knowing if they'd actually help or not. The sphere looked like metal, but that didn't mean much, and turned around. The wall of glowing blue was less than 5 meters away. Holden bent his knees, bracing for the impact of hitting the surface and hoping to absorb enough energy that he didn't just bounce off. The half meters ticked away, each second taking too long and passing too quickly. With only a meter before impact, he realized he'd been holding his breath and let out a long exhale. "Here we go," he said to no one. "Hey, boss," Alex said in a burst of radio static. Before Holden could reply, the surface of the sphere irised open and swallowed him up. After Holden passed through the portal into the interior of the sphere, he landed on the gently curving floor of a room shaped like an inverted dome. The walls were the metallic blue of the sphere's exterior. The surfaces were textured almost like moss,
and tiny lights seemed to flicker in and out of existence like fireflies. His suit reported a thin atmosphere made mostly of benzene compounds and neon. The ceiling irised closed again, its flat, unbroken surface showing no sign that there had ever been an opening. Miller stood a few meters from where Holden landed. His rumpled gray suit and pork pie hat made both mundane and exotic by the alien setting. The lack of breathable air didn't seem to bother him at all. Holden straightened his knees and was surprised to feel something like gravity's resistance. He'd felt the weight of spin and of thrust, and the natural deep pull of a gravity well. The EVA pack was heavy on his back, but the quality of it was different. He almost felt like something was pushing down on him from above, instead of the ground coming up to meet him.
"Hey, boss," Alex repeated, a note of worry in his voice.
Miller held up a hand in a don't-mind-me gesture, wordless permission for Holden to answer.
"Receiving, Alex, go ahead." "The sphere just swallowed you," Alex said. "You okay in there?"
"Yep, 5x5. But you called before I went in. What's up?"
"Just wanted to warn you that company's coming pretty close on. You can expect them in about 5 minutes at best guess."
"Thanks for the report. I'm hoping Miller won't let them in."
"Miller?" Alex and Naomi said at the same time. She must have been monitoring the exchange.
"I'll call when I know more,"
Holden said with a grunt as he finished getting the EVA pack off. It fell to the floor with a thud. That was odd. Holden turned on the suit's external speakers and said, "Miller?" He heard the sound of his own voice echoing off the walls and around the room. The atmosphere shouldn't have been thick enough for that.
"Hey,"
Miller replied, his voice unmuffled by the spacesuit, as if they were standing together on the deck of the Rosie. He nodded slowly, his sad, basset hound face twisting into something resembling a smile.
"There are others coming. They're yours?"
"Not mine, no," Holden replied. "That would be the skiff full of Martian recon marines that are coming to arrest me. Or maybe just shoot me. It's complicated."
"You've been making friends without me,"
Miller said, his tone sardonic and amused.
"How are you doing?"
Holden asked. "You seem more coherent than usual." Miller gave a short belter shrug.
"How do you mean?"
"Usually when we talk, it's like only half the signal's getting through." The old detective's eyebrows rose in surprise.
"You've seen me before?"
"On and off for the last year or so."
"Well, that's pretty disturbing,"
Miller said.
"If they're planning to shoot you, we'd better get going."
Miller seemed to flicker out of existence, reappearing at the edge of the moss-like walls. Holden followed, his body fighting with the nauseating sense of being weightless and heavy at the same time. When he drew close, he could see the spirals within the moss on the walls. He'd seen something like this before where the protomolecule had been, but this was lush by comparison. Complex and rich and deep. A vast ripple seemed to pass over the wall like a stone thrown in a pond, and despite having his own isolated air supply, Holden smelled something like orange peels and rain.
"Hey," Miller said.
"Sorry," Holden said.
"What?" "We better get going,"
the dead man said. He gestured toward what looked like a fold of the strange moss, but when Holden came close, he saw a fissure behind it. The hole looked soft as flesh at the edges, and it glistened with something. It wept.
"Where are we going?"
"Deeper," Miller said.
"Since we're here, there's something we should probably do. I have to tell you, though, you got a lot of balls."
"For what?" Holden said, and his hand slid against the wall. A layer of slime stuck to the fingers of his suit.
"Coming here?"
"You told me to,"
Holden said. You brought me. Julie brought me.
I don't want to talk about what happened to Julie, the dead man said.
Holden followed him into the narrow tunnel. Its walls were slick and organic. It was like crawling through a deep cave or down the throat of a vast animal.
You're definitely making more sense than usual. There are tools here, Miller said. They're not right, but they're here at least.
Does this mean you might still say something enigmatic and vanish in a puff of blue fireflies?
Probably.
Miller didn't expand on this, so Holden followed him for several dozen meters through the tunnel, until it turned again, and Miller led him into a much larger room.
Oh, wow, he managed to say.
Because the floor of the first room and the tunnel that led out of it had both a consistent down, Holden had thought he was moving laterally, just under the skin of the station. That couldn't have been right, because the room the tunnel opened into had a much higher ceiling than was possible if that were true. The space stretched out from the tunnel into a cathedral vast opening, hundreds of meters across. The walls slanted inward into a domed ceiling that was 20 meters off the floor in the center. Scattered across the room, in seemingly random places, were two meter-thick columns of something that looked like blue glass with black, branching veins shooting through it. The columns pulsed with light, and each pulse was accompanied by a subsonic throb that Holden could feel in his bones and teeth. It felt like enormous power, carefully restrained. A giant whispering.
Holy shit, he finally said when his breath came back. We're in a lot of trouble, aren't we?
Yeah, Miller said.
You should not have come.
Miller walked off across the room, and Holden hurried to catch up.
Wait, what? He said. I thought you wanted me here.
Miller walked around something that from a distance had looked like a blue statue of an insect, but up close was a massive confusion of metallic limbs and protrusions, like a construction mech folded up on itself. Holden tried to guess at its purpose and failed.
Why would you think that? Miller said as he walked. You don't know what's in here. Doors and corners. Never walk into a crime scene until you know there's not someone there waiting to put you down. You've got to clear the room first. But maybe we got lucky. For now.
Wouldn't recommend doing it again, though.
I don't understand.
They came to a place on the floor that was covered in what looked like cilia or plant stalks, gently rippling in a non-existent wind. Miller walked around it. Holden was careful to do the same. As they passed, a swarm of blue fireflies burst out of the ground cover and flew up to a vent in the ceiling where they vanished.
So, there was this unlicensed brothel down in Sector 18. We went thinking we'd be hauling 15, 20 people in, more maybe. Got there and the place was stripped to the stone, Miller said. It wasn't that they'd gotten wind of us, though. The Loca Grega had heard about the place. Sent their guys to clean it up. Took about a week to find the bodies. According to forensics, they'd all been shot twice in the head pretty much while we were getting one last cup of coffee. If we'd been a little bit faster, we'd have walked in on it. Nothing says fucked like opening the door on a bunch of kids who thought they'd make a quick buck off the sex trade and having an organized kill squad there for the meet and greet instead.
What has that got to do with anything?
This place is the same, Miller said. There was supposed to be something. A lot of something. There was supposed to be... Shit, I don't have the right words. An empire. A civilization. A home. More than a home. A master. Instead, there's a bunch of locked doors and the lights on a timer. I don't want you charging into the middle of that. You'll get your ass killed.
What the hell do you mean? Holden said. You, or the protomolecule, or Julie Mao, or whatever you set this whole thing up. The job, the attack, all of it. That stopped Miller. He turned around with a frown on his face.
Julie's dead, kid. Miller's dead. I'm just the machine for finding lost things.
I don't understand, Holden said. If you didn't do this, then who did?
See, now that's a good question, on several levels. Depending on what you mean by this.
Miller's head lifted like a dog catching an unfamiliar scent on the wind.
Your friends are here. We should go.
He moved off at a faster walk toward the far wall of the room. The Marines, Holden said. Could you stop them?
No,
Miller said.
I don't protect anything. I can tell the station they're a threat. There'd be consequences, though.
Holden felt a punch of dread in his gut.
That sounds bad. It wouldn't be good. Come on. If we're going to do this, we need to stay ahead of them.
The halls and passages widened and narrowed, meeting and falling away from each other like blood vessels of some massive organism. Holden's suit light seemed almost lost in the vast darkness, and the blue firefly flickers came in waves and vanished again. Along the way, they passed more of the metallic blue insect-like constructs.
What are these?
Holden asked, pointing to an especially large and dangerous-looking model as they passed it.
Whatever they need to be, Miller replied without turning around.
Oh, great, so we're back to inscrutable, are we? Miller spun around, a worried look on his face, and blinked out of existence. Holden turned. Far across the huge room, a form was coming out of the tunnel. Holden had seen similar armor before. A Martian Marine's powered armor was made of equal parts efficiency and threat. There was no escaping it. Anyone in those suits could run him down without trying. Holden switched his suit to an open frequency.
Hey, I'm right here. Let's talk about this, he said,
then started to walk toward the group. As one, all eight Marines raised their right arms and opened fire. Holden braced himself for death, even while part of his mind knew that he shouldn't have time to brace for death. At the distance they were, the rounds from their high-velocity guns would be hitting in a fraction of a second. He'd be dead long before the sound of the shots reached him. He heard the rapid and deafening buzzsaw sound of the guns firing, but nothing hit him. A diffuse cloud of gray formed in front of the Marines. When the firing finally stopped, the cloud drifted away toward the walls of the room. Bullets. They'd stopped centimeters from the gun barrels, and were now being drawn away just like the objects outside the station. The Marines broke into a fast run across the room, and Holden tried to scramble away. They were beautiful in their way. The lethal power of the suits, harnessed by years of training to make their movements seem like a dance. Even without their weapons, they could tear him limb from limb. One punch from that armor would break all the bones he had and change his viscera to a thin slurry. His only chance was to outrun them, and he couldn't outrun them. He almost didn't see the movement when it came. His focus was locked on the Martians, on the danger he knew. He didn't consciously notice that one of the insect-like things had started moving until the Marines turned to it. The alien thing's movements were fast and jagged, like a clockwork mechanism that only had full speed and full stop. It clicked toward the Marines, jerking with each step, and it loomed larger than the tallest of them by almost half a meter. They panicked in the way that people trained to expect violence panic. Two started firing with the same results as before. Another Marine's suit shifted something in its arm, and a larger barrel appeared.
Holden scooted away from the confrontation. He was sure there was shouting going on in those armored suits, but it wasn't a frequency he had access to. The large barrel went white with muzzle flash, and a slow arcing slug of metal the size of Holden's fist took to the strange air. A grenade. The ticking monster ignored it, stepping closer to the Marines, and the grenade detonated at its insectal feet where it landed. The alien thing jerked back, its appendages flailing and dust falling from its severed limbs like a smoke of fungal spores. The complex carpet of moss glowed with orange embers where the blast had burned it. And all around the Marines, a dozen other alien statues came to life. They moved faster this time. Before the Marines could begin to react, the one who'd launched the grenade was lifted gently up and ripped apart. Blood sprayed up into the air, hanging, Holden thought numbly, too long before it drifted back to the ground. The surviving Marines began to fall back, their guns pointing to the alien creatures that were swarming the dead man. While Holden watched, the Marines retreated into the far tunnel, falling back, regrouping. The alien things fell on their own injured fellow, ripping and clawing, slaughtering it as if it were the enemy as much as the Marines had been. And then, when it was gone, five of the monsters gathered together in the burned spot where the explosion had been. They shuddered, went still, shuddered again, and then from all five of them, a thin stream of opaque yellow goo spattered out onto the scar. Holden felt fascination and revulsion as the moss grabbed onto the stuff, regrowing like it had never been damaged, like the attack hadn't even existed. "Consequences," Miller said at his side. He sounded tired. Did they just turn that poor bastard into spackle?
They did, Miller said. He had it coming, though. That guy got happy with his grenade launcher. Just killed a lot of people.
What? How?
He taught the station that something moving as fast as a good baseball pitch might still be a threat.
Is it going to take revenge?
No, Miller said. It's just going to protect itself. Reevaluate what counts as dangerous. Take control of all the ships that might be a problem.
What does that even mean?
Means a really bad day for a whole lot of people. When it slows you down, it ain't gentle.
Holden felt a cold hand close on his heart. The Rossi. A look of sorrow, even sympathy, passed over the detective's face.
Maybe. I don't know, Miller said with a rueful shrug. One way or the other, a whole lot of people just died.
Chapter 23. Melba. Julie saved her. There was no other way to look at it. True to style, Holden's proxy had given everything away. Cohen, discovered, told everything he knew, and put the image he'd stolen along with it. Melba had it on her hand terminal, a portrait of the young woman as ice sculpture. She hadn't known the sound man had taken the data when she'd met with him, but she should have guessed he would. The mistake was obvious in retrospect. It ought to have ended the chase. The people in power should have seen it, shrugged, and thrown her out an airlock. Except that it came with its own misinterpretation. Here, Holden said, is Julie Mao. And that's what everyone saw. The differences that were obvious to her became invisible to others. They expected to see the protomolecule infiltrating and threatening and raising the dead, and so they saw it. She did what she could to keep anyone from noticing the similarities. She'd met Cohen on Earth with a full G pulling down. With the Thomas Prince already close to the ring's velocity limit, there was no acceleration thrust. Her cheeks looked fuller, her face round.
She'd had her hair down then, so now she pulled it back in a braid. The image had no color, so she wore a little makeup to alter the shape of her eyes and lips. Doing something radical would only call attention, so she went small. She might not even have needed to do that. Her schedule in the Thomas Prince was full. They were going to work her, work all of them like dogs. She didn't care. The service gantries and access ways would be safe. No one who knew Clarissa Mao would be there. She would stay away from the public parts of the ship as much as she could, and more often than not, she could get one of the other techs to grab a tube of something from the commissary and bring it to her. In the off shifts, she would build her arsenal. Holden was beyond her reach for the time being. It was almost funny. She'd gone to so much effort to make him seem like an unrepentant megalomaniac, and then, left to his own devices, he named himself de facto ambassador of the whole human race. Julie had fooled him, too. With any luck at all, he'd die in a firefight or get killed by the protomolecule. Her work had narrowed to destroying the evidence of Holden's innocence. It wouldn't be hard. The Rosinante had begun its life as an escort corvette on the battleship Doniger. It was well-designed and well-constructed, but also now years past its last upgrade. The weaknesses in its defense were simple. The cargo doors nearest the reactor had been damaged and repaired, and would almost certainly be weaker than the original. The forward airlock had been built with a software glitch vulnerable to hacking. Real Martian naval ships would have been updated as a matter of course, but Holden might have been sloppy. Her first hope was the airlock. A short-range access transmitter built for troubleshooting malfunctioning airlocks had found its way in among her things. If that failed, getting through the cargo door was harder. She hoped for something explosive, but the Thomas Prince took its munitions very seriously. The equipment manifests did include a half-suit exoskeleton mech. It would fit over her chest and arms. It wasn't designed for legs. And with a cutting torch to make the initial breach, it could probably bend the plating enough to let her through. It was also small and lightweight enough to carry, and her access card was a high enough grade for the system to let her take one away. Once she was on, it would be simple. Kill everyone, overload the reactor, and blow the ship to atoms. With any luck at all, it would reignite suspicions about the bomb on the Sung-un. If she got out, fine. If she didn't, she didn't. The only tricks now were getting there, and waiting like everyone else to hear what happened on the station. She was dreaming when catastrophe came. In it, she was walking through a field outside a schoolhouse. She knew that it was on fire, that she had to find a way in. She heard fire engine sirens, but their dark shapes never appeared in the sky. There were people trapped inside, and she was supposed to get them, to free them or to keep them from escaping, or both. She was on the roof, going down through a hole. Smoke billowed out around her, but she could still breathe because she'd been immunized against flames. She stretched down, fingertips brushing against low-G handholds. She realized someone was holding her wrist, supporting her as she strained in toward the darkness and fire. Ren. She couldn't look at him. Sorrow and guilt welled up in her like a flood, and she collapsed into a blue-lit bar with crash couches where all the tables should have been. Couples ate dinner and talked and screwed in the dim around her. The man across from her was both Holden and her father. She tried to speak, to say that she didn't want to do this. The man took her by the shoulders, pressing her into the soft gel. She was afraid for a moment that he'd crawl on top of her, but he brought his fists down on her chest with a killing impact.
and she woke up to the sound of klaxons and droplets of blood floating in the air. The pain in her body was so profound and inexplicable that it didn't feel like pain. It was only the sense that something was wrong. She coughed, launching a spray of blood across the room. She thought that somehow she'd triggered her false glands in her sleep, that what was wrong was only her. But the ship alarms argued that it was something worse. She reached for her hand terminal, but it wasn't in its holder. She found it floating half a meter from the door, rotating in the air. A star-shaped fracture in the resin case showed where it had hit something hard enough to break. The network access displayed a bright red bar. No status. System down. Melba pulled herself to the door and cycled it open. The dead woman, floating in the corridor, had her arms out before her. Her hair splayed around her like someone drowned. The left side of her face was oddly shaped, softer and rounder and bluer than it should have been. Her eyes were half open, the whites the bright red of burst vessels. Melba pushed past the corpse. Farther down the corridor, a sphere of blood the size of a soccer ball floated slowly toward the air intake with no sign where it had come from. In the wider corridors toward the middle of the ship, things were worse. Bodies floated at every door, in every passageway. Everything not bolted down floated now by the walls, thrown toward the bow. The soft gray walls were covered with dents where hand terminals and tools and heads had struck them. The air smelled like blood and something else, deeper and more intimate. Outside the commissary, three soldiers were using sealant foam to stick the dead to the walls, keeping them out of the way. In gravity, they would have been stacking bodies like cordwood. "You all right?" one of them said. It took Melba a second to realize that the woman was speaking to her. "I'm okay," Melba said. "What happened?"
"Who the fuck knows? You're one of the maintenance techs, yes?"
the woman said sharply.
"I am," Melba said.
"Melba Co., electrochemical."
"Well, you can get your ass to Environmental Co.," the woman said. "I'm guessing they need you there."
Melba nodded, the motion sending her spinning a little until the woman put out a hand to steady her. She'd never been in a battle or at the scene of a natural disaster. The nearest had been a hurricane that hit Sao Paulo when she was 8, and her father had hidden the family in the corporate shelter until the flooding was gone. She'd seen more of that damage on the news feeds than in person. The Thomas Prince was a scene from hell. She passed knots of people working frantically, but the dead and dying were everywhere. Droplets of blood and chips of shattered plastic formed clouds where the eddies of the recyclers pushed them together. In zero G, blood pooled in the wounds and wouldn't clear. Inflammation was worse. Lungs filled with fluid more easily. However many had died already, more would. Soon. If she hadn't been in her crash couch, she'd have been thrown into a wall at 600 meters per second, just like all the others. No, that couldn't be right. No one would have survived that. She hadn't spent much of her time on environmental decks. Most of her work before with Stani and Soledad had been with power routing. The air and water systems had technicians of their own, specialists at a higher pay grade than hers. The architecture of the rooms kept everything close without being as cramped as the Cerisier. She floated in with a sense of relief, as if reaching her goal accomplished something in itself, as if it gave her some measure of control. The air smelled of ozone and burned hair. A young man, face covered with black bruises, was stuck to the bulkhead with a rope and two electromagnets. He waved something similar to a broom with a massive mesh of fabric on the end, like a gigantic fly swatter, clearing blood from the air. His damaged face was impassive, shocked.
A thickening layer of tears encased his eyes, blinding him.
You! Who the hell are you?
Melba turned. The new man wore a Navy uniform.